Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this election day. It's Tuesday, November 5th. Currently 28 degrees in Old Town Park City. We've got some light snow showers coming down. 33 degrees in Heber City. And on the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Nate Larson. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Good morning, Wasatch back. Yeah, seeing some snow out there. Looks like I was pulling up some of the UDOT cameras. Kearns and SR 2048 looking like it's coming down pretty well, starting to stick to some of the side surfaces. Snow showers off and on throughout the day today. About 33 degrees is all we'll see for a high in Park City. And we could see a couple of inches accumulate in Park City as well. Highs near 39 in Heber, and looking like maybe a half of an inch to an inch of snow in the Heber Valley as well. So cold day today. We stay on the chilly side into tomorrow. In fact, overnight lows in the teens for Park City. Into Wednesday, we will see mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies. Highs right near freezing again tomorrow. Could see a few snowflakes linger overnight. But again, generally 1 to 3 inches for areas of Park City and about an inch, maybe less for Heber. Looking into Thursday, Friday, clearing skies, warming temperatures as well. High pressure building back in. We'll still see chilly temperatures Thursday morning. In fact, just 13 degrees is expected. 36 for the high Thursday afternoon. We'll be in the teens again Friday, but 42. So the daytime highs starting to warm back up into the weekend with high pressure building back in. Tracking another potential system for early next week. We'll start to see increasing clouds Sunday, Monday. Depending on timing, models are kind of back and forth, but maybe late Sunday. Otherwise, Monday into Tuesday, more rain and snow showers with cooling temperatures. Temperatures near 49 on Monday. Should drop, though, into Tuesday with some of that wet weather moving back in. Heber mentioned 39 today, 39 again tomorrow. Overnight lows in the teens, just single-digit overnight lows into Thursday morning, forecasting 8 degrees right now, a high of 42 that afternoon. As we get into Friday, still cold overnight, 47 for the high and back in the 50s this weekend. We'll see lots of sunshine Thursday through Saturday with some clouds starting to increase on Sunday. And again, that wet weather potential returning early next week. Highs near 54 on Monday with a chance of rain.
Okay, Nate, thank you.
You bet.
It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, and it is Election Day. A reminder that ballots cannot be mailed today. They will not count if you put them into the post office box. However, you can find a local drop box or a polling location before the polls close tonight at 8 p.m. According to the Lieutenant Governor's Office, just over 46% of Utah voters have voted early, either in person or by mail, with 800,000 ballots processed across the state. Here in Summit County, about 48% of ballots have been received and processed. In Wasatch County, more than 44% have been processed. There are 9 drop box locations around Summit County, including the Park City Library, all 3 Summit County Library locations, the County Courthouse, and Oakley City Hall. You can vote in person today at the Summit County Courthouse in Colville, the Sheldon Richens Building at Kimball Junction, and the City Hall Marsack Building here in Park City. Wasatch County has 8 drop box locations for voters, including the Senior Center or County Administration Building in Heber, Midway, or Hideout City offices, Charleston Town Hall, Walsburg Town Hall, or the County Library. And today, in-person voting will be held at the Senior Center in Heber City. Utah is one of 23 states that does allow for same-day voter registration. So if you are not registered and do want to register, you can do so by visiting one of the poll locations with 2 forms of ID. One must be a primary form of ID, including a Utah driver's license, a state-issued ID card, or your U.S. passport. The second form must be proof of residence, including a utility bill dated within the last 3 months of the election, a Social Security card, or a statement from a bank or other financial account. And again, it's that day. Get out and vote, and don't let the snow stop you. Here in Old Town, not really a big deal. Roads are still clear. If you do have any road or weather conditions to report, you can certainly text us to 435-655-8255. Well, coming up on the local news hour, stay tuned. I'll be checking in with Wasatch County Manager Dustin Graybell. He'll have a preview of tomorrow's county council meeting. Local author Scott Zuckerman previews his presentation about Major Sebastian Thomas Tosto, the subject of his new book, Nothing Left to Prove, Nothing Left to Hide. And the CEO of Summit Land Conservancy, Cheryl Fox, in to discuss some open space issues. Well, the Wasatch County Council meets tomorrow starting at 4 o'clock. On the phone with a meeting preview, I have County Manager Dustin Graybell. Good morning, Dustin.
Good morning, Leslie.
Opening the meeting is a presentation from Utah's Mounted Thunder. No staff report. I have no idea what you're talking about here.
Yeah, so this is an event that has been held the last 2 years in Wasatch County at our event center. I believe one of the council members asked to have it put on so that they could report back kind of the progress of the event. It's a mounted shooters event where they use special weapons that can pop balloons as they ride around on horses in an arena.
Okay. So it's going to happen, or it has happened? He's given a...
I believe it already happened in October, and so they're providing a report on the event.
All right. Also, a discussion and consideration of supporting trail maintenance through the Wasatch Back Trails Foundation. What are we talking about here? In kind, or are we talking financial support, or...
So this last year, through our TAP board, Wasatch County awarded the Wasatch Trails Foundation a grant for some trail improvements up by connecting the Wild Trailhead up into Park City system. And I think what they're interested in is looking at kind of more of a long-term relationship, similar to one that they have in Summit County and with Park City, on kind of ongoing maintenance for backcountry trails. So I think it's kind of a discussion about you know, the appetite to do those types of things and prioritizing that type of funding with our TAP funds.
Any idea how much the foundation did receive in its recent TAP grant?
I want to say it's something on the order of about $30,000. I believe this around they're asking for something like an annual commitment of about $60,000 for trail maintenance. They would like to stand up a crew that's dedicated to Wasatch County and do this in partnership with Heber City, Wasatch County, and Midway City.
Hmm. Now, does the Trails Foundation, have they provided a priority list to the council, or?
To my knowledge, not yet, and I think that's going to be part of the discussion at our meeting tomorrow.
All right. Also, a discussion and consideration of amending the development code to remove the MIDA liaison department. Why are we doing this?
So originally, when we created the MIDA liaison department, it was created as an independent department under the county council, parallel to my role. Since we Mike Davis retired, we've hired a new MIDA liaison that has more of a split duties between some project management and MIDA duties. And that is going to fall under my department. And so rather than have kind of vestigial code that doesn't really apply to the current setup, what we're talking about is just adjusting the code for reflecting how we're currently operating.
Okay, so that liaison department, as I recall, it was kind of set up to ensure that the county isn't taken advantage of by a state board that has only, what, one elected Wasatch County official on it? So doing away with it, do we still have that same oversight?
Yeah, actually, by having, so our new MIDA liaison, Richard Breitenbeker, he's as involved as Mike Davis ever was on the issues that we're dealing with MIDA. And so I think if anything, we're paying more attention now because many of the plans are coming to fruition. So it doesn't really change at all the county's emphasis on or ability to monitor MIDA. What it does, though, is reflect the operational reality of that falling under my department and instead of being an independent department, if that makes sense.
Okay, so what's Richard's new title?
So he's the MIDA liaison and a project manager. And so his duties include those things that Mike Davis was doing before. And then he's also managing some of our construction projects that the county's undergoing right now.
Okay, so in terms of... The code changes, it says that you're eliminating the coordinator position, but we've now just renamed it a liaison position.
So the code was created to reflect, like I said, the independent status of that office being parallel to the county manager's office, so that the MIDA liaison previously reported directly to the county council. What we're talking about now is just an organizational shift where the MIDA liaison reports to me and changing the code to reflect that.
Okay. What about the budget? Are you about ready to wrap
that
up?
Yeah, we have given the council the tentative budget. We'll be kind of presenting the document on tomorrow. This will be a pretty brief item because we're really just giving the council the tentative budget. We'll make sure that it's publicly available in the format that we share with the council as well. We're still tweaking some of the formatting, which is why we don't have the final budget out yet, or the final tentative budget, I should say. But what we're hoping to do is come back next week during our work meeting and have a little bit more robust discussion about the details in the tentative budget. Because it's a relatively big document, we want to give the council some time to digest it and then discuss it next week at our work meeting.
Okay. How big of a budget is it, this tentative budget?
You know, our budget, it tends to be about $60 million on an annual basis. And this budget reflects, I think, just a few key priority areas that we are addressing. One of them, big ones, is that we are trying to make sure that we're sustainably replacing our snowplow fleets. In the past, we had used some mineral lease board money to purchase kind of a large set of those. And we're now getting to the point where those are reaching the end of their useful life. And the mineral lease dollars have changed really significantly in the intervening years. So what we're suggesting is that the county start to fund annually a replacement of three plow trucks in perpetuity. And that's gonna cost, the trucks are also twice as expensive as they used to be. So it's a pretty significant investment. We think that each truck costs about $300,000 after they're fully outfitted. And so this will be a really significant investment. But one of the great things is that we are not asking for any additional tax dollars to do it. All of the changes that are proposed in this year's tentative budget don't include any truth in taxation. We're using only existing revenue sources to do all of the things there.
Okay, but we're talking about $1 million a year forever, huh?
Yeah, basically. And that's one of the ways that we've been able to get by is that we had used those one-time dollars to do it, but we need to make sure that we are budgeting to sustainably replace those on an ongoing basis.
Okay, so about the $60 million budget, what kind of increase is it from a year ago?
So it kind of depends on which areas you're talking about. One of our capital improvement funds does include the start of the construction of our new administration building. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit, and last year we also budgeted for the full or most of the construction of the courthouse project. So if you look at it in aggregate, it doesn't look like it's changed all that much. The general fund is changing up a little bit just to reflect some of the new dollars that we're getting from our transit funds. There's about $1 million increase related to the new transit sales tax that has a public safety component. So we're transferring about $900,000 from our transit fund into the general fund, and that's affecting some of the costs in there. So, you know, it's a little bit of a moving target as just the county is growing so quickly. It is I think about a 20% increase overall, but that is not reflective of necessarily just costs increasing. There's additional revenues coming in from some other sources.
Okay, and as you mentioned, is a no tax increase proposed budget.
Correct. There's no truth in taxation this year, and the county's not asking for any additional property taxes or anything like that.
All right. Does the budget allow for any more full-time employees?
It does. We're including a few new positions in the sheriff's office using some of those new transit dollars. So there are also some other projects in the sheriff's office related to purchasing equipment and planning on doing a master plan for the sheriff's office. We kind of have started over there with the courthouse expansion. We're now looking at what does the rest of the campus where the sheriff's office is located at look like, and how do we prepare in the coming years for what the future needs of the sheriff's office is.
All right. And what about school resource officers? Summit County, I know, had to come up with like five of them.
So we actually, a few years ago, partnered with Heber City and the Wasatch County School District, and we have had school resource officers in all of Wasatch County schools, I want to say for the last maybe 4 or 5 years. We share the cost of those. The school district pays for the half of the year that they are school resource officers, and either Heber City or Wasatch County, depending on which school and which officers, are paying the other half while we utilize them during the summer months. There is one additional potential school resource officer if a charter school is, we haven't worked out the details exactly of whether they're willing to cover their half of a cost, but if so, then it would be a similar arrangement available to us so that we get half of a year of a patrol deputy and they get a school resource officer.
All right. At 6 o'clock, three public hearings, I believe, with regard to the Sky Ridge Lodge will be held. They're all being done separately because they're just different issues, or?
So there are different parts of the same approval that are all necessary to be considered and heard as public hearings. So really what I suspect will happen is the council will have presentations and hear public hearings on all three of the items because they are interrelated, and they probably won't vote on them, you know, here next presentation. They'll vote on all three of them at the end after having heard all of the presentations and all of the public input on those items. And that public input is, I think, a required and an important step for the county council to let the public be able to have their say and raise any concerns and be able to address them prior to them considering the approval.
Okay, and what we're talking about, I think, is that 75-foot tall lodge that is receiving a special exception for it to be built 30 feet over the, 40 feet over the height limit. Planning Commission has already approved it. So it's like they have to prove everything or nothing, huh, the council?
So there is a little bit of confusion. I think some of the public have this particular project mixed up with an adjacent project that's already been approved. So Sky Ridge has built a golf academy and an HOA facility and a golf pro shop. And associated with that is some golf driving range. There is a perception among some of the public that this is going to be a top golf facility, you know, like you might see on the Wasatch Front with multiple stories and high nets and lots of lights. And that's not the case at all. It's actually already done. And while they have partnered with Top Golf to utilize some of the technology in the golf bays, there are no nets, there are no lights. It's only a single level. I think maybe there is a roof that you can drive from as well, but it's already done. So I wanted to put that out there. One, this approved council's considering does not include any golf facilities, and there is no Top Golf that is going to be built over there. Whatever is built is already built. So to answer your original question, though, on does the council have the ability to consider all of this or none of this, I think it ultimately only the... So there have been two public hearings. There have been a Planning Commission public hearing and also a Jordan-Ell Specially Planned Area Committee meeting. So these two recommending bodies are just that. They make recommendations to the county council, who ultimately have the final say on if they want to grant these types of exemptions. Now, we've been talking about this for the better part of a year, and the main consideration was what was the least number of ways that we could grant exemptions, because we knew that this facility was going to go in. We didn't know what the final form was going to be, and that this method of approval means that we grant the fewest number of exemptions than if they were to apply for a rezone, which was something they originally asked for, was to designate this area as a village core. But a village core is a much higher density, much higher intensity use that we felt like wasn't appropriate for that area. And that this method of using the approvals that we're considering tomorrow means that it really is only parking and the height that are being considered. And I think we did a site visit there so that the council could get a sense of the topography of the site is such that, yes, there is a difference in the height. I think we expected that to be the case, but in this particular geographic situation, I think its impact is relatively mitigated because it kind of cascades down the hill as it goes. It's quite a steep site.
Yeah, and when you and I talked last, I mean, you talked about how to get this exemption or exception was basically because it's part of the MIDA special project area, and that was, you were kind of using the military service as a way to kind of get around this exception, because my question was, are you concerned about this having to deal with special exceptions going forward? But again, I mean, when you look at all of the special project area within the MIDA area, how much of the development that is happening there really benefits military service people? I mean, are we talking like a 20th of the development units, 10th? I mean,
I think this facility is a good example, and the golf before it. So one of the things we talked about before was that this facility is part of the tax increment financing for the golf academy and equestrian facility. So I just mentioned the golf academy that was approved last year. And I think that is directly related to MIDA's mission when it comes to this area. The idea is that there are the military welfare and recreation sites all around the world. They have them in Germany and Switzerland and, there are other places in the United States. And that with this area being able to be a four-season welfare creation area for military members, the golf and equestrian aspects of that I think plays exactly into what MIDA is intending and delivering to our military service members. So yes, there is an exemption being considered based on the height of this and some of the parking considerations, but I think it's one of the ways in which both the county is addressing these legitimate needs and the goals of MIDA while also being able to serve the public. So I think it's important to consider that there is not kind of this blank check. Wasatch County has been asked many times to consider development agreements in other development projects, and we have emphatically refused those because it didn't make sense in those circumstances. Just because a project is hard to build doesn't mean that it warrants any kind of special exemption. Hmm. But this hotel, in the connection with MIDA and the way in which that Wasatch County is considering it, I think warrants those special considerations in the same way that there were questions about the Heber Valley Temple that were unique about that facility that warranted the same approval process. So we're not just kind of opening any floodgates. We are trying to be as careful as we can and use the right tools for the right problem. And we feel like this is the right tool for this particular problem.
Okay. I mean, because it really feels like just a ruse for more development and more growth. And that's what you hear from people. It's like we're growing too fast. And again, with the way that it's been set up, that, you know, it just goes before the MIDA board and not before, you know, until it gets to the county council. I mean, things are just getting approved so quickly. And again, nobody wants to not give our military service people anything they want. More fun, the better for them. I think we all agree with that. But when we're talking about the numbers that we're actually serving, who can actually afford to do that? It just seems so small compared to the amount of development that's being approved.
Yeah, well, I certainly can understand where that concern is coming from. There is a lot of growth happening in Wasatch County. I think it's important to keep in mind that the Jordanelle area has been planned for many decades to have this level of growth. The county created the Jordanelle specially planned area because we saw the potential of that Jordanelle area being this kind of four season, you know, it's almost a mini Tahoe, right? That there is a better mountains, great, better ski facilities, a little bit smaller lake that is nearby. So when counties engage in any land use entity engages in those types of approvals, we don't necessarily set the timeline on when people are going to act on those approvals, but we laid the groundwork many decades ago for exactly what is happening now. And I think a lot of the other concerns in the county when it comes to growth have more to do with what is happening inside the municipalities that the counties don't directly have control over. You know, that's one of the things that we're discussing next week is Heber City's potential annexation of a large section, you know, 4,000 acres. I think the county has a lot of concerns about that. But the state gives the counties very few tools to actually actively oppose the types of developments that the cities are interested in. So a lot of the questions and concerns are best directed to the municipalities that end up annexing some of these properties and entitling densities that might have been above what the county was considering. We're trying to isolate our growth up to the Jordanelle Basin. It's away from the Heber Valley, and we think it's a place where growth makes sense. What we would like to do is preserve as much as possible the other parts of our county that are more rural and more scenic, and how do we best do that? We feel like we're trying to coordinate with Heber City on it. And that's why they've expressed an interest in setting up regular meetings with us to do just that.
Okay. Dustin, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Scott Zuckerman will be giving a presentation about Major Sebastian Thomas Tosto, the subject of his book, Nothing Left to Prove, Nothing Left to Hide. He'll be at the Kimball Junction Branch Library later this week. He joins me now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so maybe first just start by telling us a little bit about yourself. You're a medical doctor turned author?
That's correct. I first became interested in writing in high school. I had a very prominent high school English teacher. He wasn't prominent at the time. He was a great teacher, but he went on to become prominent. His name was Frank McCourt, and he later, after he was my teacher, went on to win a Pulitzer Prize for his memoir, Angela's Ashes. And he was a great inspiration, and when I'm sitting and writing, I can still hear his voice kind of barking at me while I was sitting in that high school classroom.
Yeah, so you decided, well, not a whole lot going on with authorship, but went on to medical school then.
That's right. I was always planning to be a doctor, but I always had sort of an interest in writing. I always enjoyed it, and through a series of circumstances, I came to meet people whose stories needed to be told. So my first book I started writing in 2011. That's the story of a World War II veteran who never told his the details of his life to anyone until he allowed me to interview him. I finished that book in 2015. It was published in 2017. That's Dreams of My Comrades. That's when I reconnected with Tom. Tom was one of my medical students. He's the subject of my most current book, Nothing Left to Prove, Nothing Left to Hide. He was one of my students back in 1992 in New Jersey, and we'd sort of lost touch with one another, and he had a colorful earlier life. So I thought back to him, reconnected with him, and I discovered that after 9/11, he sold his medical practice, joined the 82nd Airborne Division, became a paratrooper at the age of 50, deployed to Afghanistan, Iraq, and rose to the level of brigade surgeon. So my feeling was this man's story needs to be told. So I set out on a journey. I actually started the journey in 2015, right after I finished my first book. I set out on a journey to tell his story. I sort of put it on the back burner for a while. 2020, after COVID happened, and my acupuncture practice, that's what I do for a living is medical acupuncture. That's what I do now. My acupuncture practice sort of took a pretty big deterioration, if you will. People not really interested in interacting with non-urgent medical situations. And I really sat down, put, I'll say pen to paper, but it was really finger to keyboard. And it took me 2 years to get all the information I needed and write this book, and it was published in November of 2023. So that's sort of my journey that I've taken to get this book on the market.
All right, so how did you say you knew?
Tom?
Tom,
back in 1992, I was the director of a pediatric ER in New Jersey, and Tom was one of my medical students. He was actually older than me by 8 years, went back after having this colorful early life that I'll keep under wraps for now. He went back to medical school and became a physician at a fairly advanced age, certainly not the norm. And he and I developed a really close relationship during that period of time, but as often happens, we fell out of contact for probably, well, 2 decades. We didn't contact one another. But he was happy to hear from me when I finally reached out to him.
Yeah, and then so how did that connection and reconnection happen?
Nowadays you can Google anybody. And I Googled him and found out how I could get in touch with him. And when I reached out to him, it was almost like he was expecting my phone call. It was very interesting experience.
So this colorful early life, is that part of the book?
It is part of the book. And the book, of course, talks about his military career and the experiences that he had while he was deployed and surrounding his deployments. But I think really the cornerstone of the book is the details of his family life and how the drama and interpersonal relationships in his family led him down the path that he took, because his family is unique. And, of course, the path he took is extremely unique. I would say there's nobody who has a resume like Tom Tosto. I mean, it's a very unique circumstance to become a physician at the age he did and then to give up his practice when he did and become a paratrooper. You're not even allowed to become a paratrooper at the age of 50 anymore. The cutoff age is 36 to go to jump school.
And what did he want to do that for?
Well, his early life included some secrets, some things that he was not proud of. And really, he sought redemption for that. And I like to think of this book as being a story of his journey toward redemption and finally allowing me to tell his story is his ultimate redemption, I believe.
Did he have some misgivings at first?
He did have some misgivings, but I'm honored that he trusted me, and I think I did right by him. I think I told his story in a compassionate fashion that would lead the reader to agree with his redemption, that he has redeemed himself for his earlier transgressions.
All right. Now, back to your first book, Dream of Comrades. That went on to win, like, first place in the nonfiction category, I read, in the 2015 Utah Original Writing Competition.
It did.
So do you feel like you've missed your calling here?
No, I can still write. I mean, I enjoy it. I still have stories to tell. Actually, part of the journey in both books was to find other veterans with whom my primary subject served. So my first book, I found every living member of my subject's battalion. And I either interviewed them. There weren't many. Those guys are much older. They were. I interviewed them either by phone. Some I got some mail or email correspondence. And my wife and I actually flew to Louisiana to interview one of the men who is an extremely colorful character. For this book also, I found other men with whom Tom served and told his story through their perspective, through their experience with him. Each of them knew Tom only from a very specific lens, if you will. So I interviewed Major David Johnson, who was Tom's medical officer in Afghanistan. I interviewed Sergeant Ben Martin, who was his platoon sergeant in Iraq. So by getting all those different interviews, I was able to piece together Tom's story one part at a time. And along the way, telling these other veteran stories. I'm very proud that this presentation I'm doing on Thursday is in such proximity to Veterans Day, because these men and women, in my books, they're men, but the men and women who serve in our military deserve to have their stories told. They're unique. They serve on our behalf, and it's a privilege to me to be able to tell their stories and try to educate the public about what these individuals go through on our behalf.
All right. So you're going to be at the Summit County Library, Kimball Junction branch, Thursday at 6:30. How's that going to work? Are you going to be doing a reading first?
I'm not going to do a reading. I've got actually a very nice slide presentation, and I think one of the unique aspects of the slide presentation is that some of my slides include excerpts from the video interviews I did. All the interviews for this book were done by Zoom, which is a really great tool. It saved me from having to fly all over the country. So I actually included those video excerpts of Tom and Tom's sister, which was a very interesting interview because they had quite a contentious relationship, and several of the men with whom he served. I think that's going to give the audience a real unique opportunity to see the characters in the book and hear them in their own voice and see their images on the screen. Hmm. So it's going to be probably about a 30 or 40 minute slide presentation and then Q&A. And of course I'll have books to for sale, and it's an honor always for me to sign books if people ask me to.
Okay, now Tom, was he happy with the outcome of the book?
Well, I think so. Tom's not the most communicative individual, which presented me with quite a challenge in writing the book, and that's why I chose to write the book in such a challenging fashion. Each chapter is in a different person's first-person narrative, and partly I had to tell it that way because Tom is not the best storyteller. He's not the most communicative. And that, again, comes from his upbringing to some extent. He lived in a family of not the best communicators.
Hmm. Was he able to provide you with some photos for the book?
Oh, yeah. I've got some great photos of even his father was a World War II veteran. And that's part of what led Tom down this path. He always felt like he was in the shadow of his dad. And I've got some great photos of his dad serving in Alaska during World War II.
Okay. What else are you working on now? Anything else?
Well, my next project is my own story and my journey through the world of medicine. But I may have to put that on the back burner once again, because one of the characters in this book is interested in having me write his whole story, and that's Major Dave Johnson. And I'm working with Dave to see if I can, I don't want to coerce him, but if I can convince him that his story will be told compassionately, thoroughly, and in a way that he could be proud of.
Okay. Anything else you want to tell us?
No, that's about it. It's just a privilege for me to be able to share these veteran stories with the general public, particularly in my own hometown of Park City.
Okay. Dr. Scott Zuckerman will be giving a presentation again this Thursday night at the Kimball Junction Library at 6:30 about his book, Nothing Left to Prove, Nothing Left to Hide. Thanks so much for your time this morning.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, in the studio now with an update from Summit Land Conservancy, I have CEO Cheryl Fox. Good morning.
Good morning.
First off, I guess you're hiring again? You were hiring last month. Did you find that person?
We did. We found a new stewardship specialist. We are actually very excited. Our conservation leadership intern was the successful candidate there. So every year we're able to offer a conservation leadership internship thanks to some generous donors. And it's a summer-long program where we are able to kind of give a person an opportunity to see a lot of different aspects of how a land trust works. And at the end of their internship, we were able to take them to the National Land Trust Alliance Conference, which is called Rally. And so we did that. And this year, our person, Alana, was able to spend a lot of time in the stewardship world. And was ultimately the successful candidate. So we were really happy to have some excellent people making applications. So that was great.
Okay, so you're looking for now an engagement manager.
And now we're looking for an engagement manager. And so this position is, we're hoping to find somebody who does have experience already, probably in the nonprofit world, putting on events, some donor management, this type of thing. So will help us really, sharpen up. That's not the word. Will help us really manage our events. You know, we have the Blue Sky Bash, we have the breakfast every year, all of our hikes and outdoor activities, our volunteer program, managing all of that. And then as well as, as we're growing and doing more work in Wasatch County and Morgan County, helping us reach out to those communities as well.
All right. I missed Hoppy Hour, but it sounds like it was a great success.
It's always a lot of fun. It was on October 10th. We're so grateful to Top of Maine for hosting a really great party for us. And of course, Niels Imboden for brewing the best beer of the year, I think, the Clothing Hoptional. He really has to be very clever with that, because every year, you know, the hops are different. Some years we have lots of them. This year there were a fewer because of the weird weather we had over the course of the summer. But that beer is so great, and you can still get it at Top of Maine, and which is formerly the Wasatch Brew Pub, and also at the Roadhouse Grill, formerly Squatters.
All right, and on your recommendation, I did try it, because I am not an IPA person either. Yeah, it was really nice.
It's not an IPA, actually. It is a wild hops ale, and I think I describe it as it tastes more green to me. So maybe that's juicy, but not that tart, sharp IPA kind of beer.
Yeah. All right, you have 5 easements transactions already funded to close next year. And are these
That's
all
right.
those Echo Canyon parcels that we were talking about last month?
So these are not in Echo Canyon. So we closed 4,200 acres in Echo Canyon in September. That was pretty exciting. Those landowners were incredibly patient. And that was the second easement transaction that they had done with us. I really feel honored when landowners are willing to step up a second time. And at this point, we have a number of landowners who are, coming back to, they've done one project over here on 800 acres or something like that, and then they're like, let's do another one. So the projects that we have lined up for 2025, 3 of them are large rangeland parcels that are actually kind of up outside of Hoytsville, sort of to the east of Hoytsville. Well, one is to the east of Hoytsville, and then 2 of them are in, they're adjacent. One of them is in Morgan, and then the other one is in Weber County. So it's kind of, if you drive 84 up to Ogden, that's off to the north, and it's those hillsides up there that are under a lot of threat of development.
Okay.
And there's sage grouse habitat.
All right. You had put in those applications for funding on the adjacent parcels next to that 4,200 acres
right.
in Echo Canyon. What's the turnaround on something like that?
So those applications were due at the beginning of October, and they are long and involved, and then the staff at the federal government, the Natural Resources Conservation Services, goes out and visits the property and makes sure there's no toxic dumping and things like that. So those hazardous site visits have taken place, and we will probably hear early in 2025 if we've been awarded the funding for those.
Okay, and that federal funding is based on that legislation that was approved. Once that money dries up, are you going to have this kind of success that you have?
Yeah, that's a good question. You know, the Inflation Reduction Act that funded, you know, a lot of other things, roads and trains and whatnot, also put more money into the Farm Bill programs that the land trusts like us use. And because we had already been doing a lot of work with those Farm Bill programs and had become already a certified entity, we have the capacity and the staff and the relationships to really be successful in those applications. So there was, I mean, a magnitude of 10 in terms of additional dollars in those programs. And so it will eventually dry up, probably in about 5 years. And so our goal is to get as much of that money into Utah as possible before it dries up.
So those five parcels that you've already funded them then to close next year, they're taken care of.
Yeah, they've already been approved for federal funding. We are still working on some state funding. And also, you know, there's always that gap where individual donors make it possible. So if we don't have the last, sometimes it's a $200,000, sometimes it's $50,000, that we have to have the final dollars to put the whole transaction together. So that's where individual giving is so important to our work, because we would lose the millions from the federal government and other sources if we didn't have that final piece. So individual giving is really the glue that keeps all of this happening.
Yeah.
So, and in addition to the three large rangeland parcels that are already funded for 2025, we have parcels that are in the meadow area of the Camas Meadows, and we're pretty excited about that too. So one being the Ure property and the other part of the Ure property, and the other being another 100 acres in the meadow.
Yeah. So when you see this individual going, is it done just like through the Blue Sky Bash?
Yes.
And then other events like that where it just kind of comes in big spurts?
Well,
or do you see, you know, daily donations?
You know, that is, it's all of the above, actually, yes. And, you know, when we look at individual giving, so yes, people who come to the Blue Sky Bash and, you know, raise their hand for the paddle or, you know, buy an auction item. It's people who come to our conservation breakfast and make gifts. It is, you know, donors who, as we get to this time of year, are writing checks or, you know, participating in other activities coming up, like on November 15th. Those kinds of things are all goes to help us make these transactions possible.
One other issue I wanted to ask you about before we run out of time, conservation burial plans. Where do the
That's
things
right.
stand with that? Because you were looking at Oakley, I think.
That's right. So we were invited by the mayor of Oakley to come in and see if a parcel of land that the city already owns and has owned for many, many years would be appropriate for a conservation cemetery. A conservation cemetery is a little bit, it's a step up from green burial, and you have to have a conservation easement on the land so that it really does ensure that the people who are being laid to rest there, that their legacy is permanent and it is forever, and it contributes to ongoing restoration and attention to the landscape. So the question now before the City Council of Oakley is whether or not they do want to set aside a certain amount of land for this conservation burial. If they say we will... What we're hoping is that the City Council will say yes if a site assessment says it's safe. And when, you know, we have lined up an organization to do the site assessment, we are looping in the Summit County Health Department because we feel like their outside expertise would be super useful. You know, there's a lot of rumor and misunderstanding out there about human burial. And that is largely put out there by the funeral industry, who would like us to buy expensive caskets and concrete vaults and formaldehyde and things like that. Those things are actually really bad for the environment. A natural conservation burial is actually the best thing to do with our resources when we're done with them. Lay them to rest in the ground. It's safe, it's clean. But we won't go forward unless we have a really thorough site visit.
Yeah, so when does that happen?
So I believe the city is thinking about having a vote later on this month. I think it's the 20th. And they've already taken public comment. I think if people wanted to comment, they could, you know, still write letters and things like that. But that's where we are.
Okay, we'll check in next time.
Okay,
thanks,
you.
Cheryl.